What kind of law do you practice?
Maritime law.
On what grounds could you possibly prevail?
Grounds? Who cares about grounds? Cases always come down to who the jury likes better.
Mr. Foley, I must warn you that if you attempt to belly rag or bulldoze this witness, I shall take very dim view of it.
Your lordship is most pretty.
Very well, then you may proceed.
Cash settlement. I could have figured that out, you button-down maggot!
You have any cream?
Oh, yes, of course. Where are my manners?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 363. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. How are you? How'd you enjoy those Nevada results if they came in?
Oh, yeah. Fantastic Nevada results that we know about. We'll see if we can record two versions of this. Ah, what a disaster. Biggest disaster since Iowa. Okay, Brian, this one will be... Oh, fantastic job. Of course, Nevadans are better than Iowans, and they executed
in every way. I mean, let's, you know.
Surprise win by Bloomberg, who wasn't even on the ballot. I can't believe it. Yeah. I mean, how hard would it be for Bloomberg to personally pay every single caucus goer to vote for him? Wouldn't be that hard. I mean, it's Nevada. How many?
Yeah, that would be a crime. I mean, just so we're clear that.
Oh,
would
sorry. Do crimes matter, Andrew? Do crimes is that still a thing? Somebody will arrest him or something? Look at this guy. Crimes. All right. Well, speaking of that, let's I think you have some more teasers. It's a little teaser segment. It's official pre. We should add this to the official segment list. Teaser segment, go.
Yeah, teaser segment. Next week, lots of you have sent me the delightfully mad lawsuit by George Zimmerman against Liz Warren and Pete Buttigieg. Yes, Larry Klayman is his lawyer. Yes, it's ridiculous. No, we don't have time to cover it this week. But I promise you, I have seen it. I have read. I have consumed alcohol while reading it. I have laughed. And I will share my thoughts with you.
Yeah, I don't want to be a buzzkill, but I can't really have a sense of humor about that.
That's fair. That is fair. And
just murdered a black man, a child, essentially.
And part of tearing that apart is the ridiculous injustice at the system. I mean, the fact that this person is not behind bars and is out and playing footsie with Fox News and running around with the conservative Republican establishment tells you everything you need to know about that side of the aisle. So yeah, no argument there.
Ugh, sorry to be a buzz.
No,
buddy.
Hey, personally, buzzkill away. So that is an absolutely valid point. And you know, I still do believe the law matters. So, you know, that's important for us to say.
This guy with the law.
Yeah.
Again, how many callbacks can you do this joke, you know, about the law mattering? Okay. I kid, sort of. All right. Well, that teaser aside, let's get to our first segment, which was, you know, we might as well permanently name the segment Andrew Was Wrong. It's like, it's usually unclear, but Andrew was potentially wrong on the emoluments episode. What do you got for
I'm
us?
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe.
Yeah, so there are two things I was definitely wrong about. So Seth Barrett Tillman wrote in response to show 361 to say three things. First, he said, you said 30 days to appeal. I think it is 45 to seek rehearing, reconsideration where the defendant is a government agency or official, and 90 days to seek Supreme Court review. That is correct. That is Rule 40 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, which otherwise require a petition for panel rehearing to be filed within 14 days. And I went off the top of my head because usually I'm in a private party situation. So I'm stuck in the 14-day rule. And I was guessing 30 without looking at it. It is 45. Verdict, 100% wrong on that one. So
fair enough.
Second, he says, you said one of the other emoluments clause cases is also before the DC circuit. The other two are before the Second Circuit, Crew versus Trump, where the DOJ is seeking an en banc review. That is correct. And the Fourth Circuit, the DC and Maryland versus Trump, that's the Brian Frosch, the best case in my view, where we are waiting for an en banc review by the Fourth Circuit. So that is correct. I was thinking of the latter case. I said it was before the DC Circuit. It is before an en banc review of the entire Fourth Circuit. So I was 100% wrong on that one too. So not looking good for me. Here's where I hope to make up for it.
All right.
On the substantive point, Professor Tillman says, because I recommended that now that the Democrats control the House, they could bring an emoluments clause case as the entire House of Representatives. And Professor Tillman writes, Pelosi seeking to bring a suit in the name of the House as a whole would probably fail. Bethune-Hill seems to indicate that both houses of a bicameral legislature must bring a claim belonging to the legislature as a whole. And here, I strongly disagree, not just on what I think ought to happen, but on how I think those cases get applied. So let me tell you about Bethune-Hill. This is...
Yeah, I've been... all my life I've been wanting to know about Bethune-Hill.
This is a 2019 Supreme Court decision with a little bit of a strange alignment. It is the court's liberal wing minus Justice Breyer plus Justice Thomas and also plus Justice Gorsuch, right? So Thomas, Gorsuch, Sotomayor, Kagan, and opinion written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg with the other four judges on the bottom. So getting three conservatives and Stephen Breyer. So kind of an oddball arrangement. This involved the 2010 census. Virginia, at the time, a red state and in the throes of sort of Tea Party mania, the then Republican Virginia legislature with a Republican Virginia governor redrew legislative districts for the state Senate and House of Delegates. And of course, because it was Republicans redrawing districts, they redrew them in racially gerrymandered ways. And so in 12 of those districts, voters went and under the Voting Rights Act sued to say, hey, these districts are racially gerrymandered. There were multiple trials with the Virginia House of Delegates defending its racially gerrymandered districts each time. In June 2018, after the second bench trial, a three-judge district court in the Eastern District of Virginia, again, that's the special three-judge panels that are convened by the Voting Rights Act. Usually, it's just one judge at the trial court level. VRA cases, you get a three-judge panel. They struck down the districts, and they enjoined Virginia from conducting any elections for the office of delegate in the challenged districts, in those 12 districts, until a new redistricting plan is adopted. This was before the general election. Elections were coming up. So the court said, basically, Virginia has 4 months to redraw those districts. And quick sidebar on 2017 and a little like why you should always vote. Virginia's House of Representatives, House of Delegates, was two-thirds Republican in 2016. But Hillary Clinton won the state of Virginia statewide against Donald Trump. And so Democrats had a plan to retake the Virginia House of Delegates for the first time in 20 years. And in the 2017 election, so they have every 2 years, but they're odd numbered years, right? So in the 2017 elections, Democrats cleanly won in 14 districts. And that gave them 49 seats. So a 50-49 minority. And then it all came down to a rematch of Democrat Shelley Simons versus Republican David Yancey in District 94. There was an unofficial recount, then there was an official recount. The recount put Simons, the Democrat, ahead by, I'm not making this up, one vote.
Wow.
And then Yancey went to court to get an injunction because one of the ballots that was excluded for him, and I have viewed this ballot, I'm going to try and link it in the show notes, is very clearly a Yancey ballot, right? It's a ballot. It votes for Republicans in every other position. And then there are two people marked in the House of Delegates race. Simons is marked, and then there's a line scratched through it, and then Yancey is marked. It's a Yancey ballot. Okay. And the court agreed. They said, yep, that's your ballot. That left them tied after the recount.
Wow.
11,608 to 11,608. Do you know what they do in Virginia when you finish an election tied?
Oh, it's some old-timey law that they have to fight to the death or something?
I wish. They have
like a horse pick the winner. Yeah. I don't
know. They flip a coin.
Oh, my gosh.
They flipped a coin. Yancey won, and the Republicans held the House 51 to 49 until they lost it in 2019. Now, 2018, again, was part of a blue wave election, and the Democrats recaptured the Virginia governorship, all of the major statewide offices, including Attorney General and the Virginia Senate. And in 2019, they would retake the Virginia House of Delegates. But in 2018...
Well, and by the way, Virginia's just been killing it lately. I keep seeing all these headlines of what they're doing legislatively, yeah. And it just seems really cool. Yeah,
this is what happens when you get involved. So, A,
yeah,
you know...
Elections matter. Vote.
You could have changed... Like, literally, one more person in this district could have spared us from two more years of reactionary conservatives controlling the Virginia House of Delegates. One vote. Yeah, so in 2018... You have a quote, Republican House on a coin flip, and the rest of the state of Virginia is blue. And that's when this decision comes down, which says, oh, and by the way, this Republican map is racist garbage. So then the now Democratic Virginia Attorney General says, okay, yeah, we are not appealing this decision, right? Yeah. The Republicans drew a garbage racist map, and you gave us 4 months to figure it out. We'll do our best to figure it out, but we're not appealing this decision. We agree with this. And shockingly, because you would have to have agreement between the Republican House and the Democratic Senate and governor, in that 4 months, they were unable to come up with a plan. And so the court plan went into effect. But then the last ditch, coin flip red Republican House of Delegates sued to block that map from going into effect. And they said, the court doesn't get to draw up maps. That's our job. And that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And on the 5-4 ruling that I just described, the Supreme Court said, now, you know what? You don't have standing, Virginia House of Delegates, right? You got to do everything it is that you think you might be able to do in terms of weighing in on maps. But even if we had given you, right, even if there was nothing hanging over your head, you can't pass a Republican map with a Democratic Senate and governor anyway. So you don't have an injury and you don't have standing. That is the case that Professor Tillman thinks means you have to bring a claim on behalf of the legislature, on behalf of, by both houses. Here's why I think he's wrong. Okay. The Supreme Court did indeed say on those facts that the House did not have standing to challenge the court mandated plan, but that's because they already got to do their job, right? There was no scenario in which the Republican plan was going to pass the Democratic Senate and or get signed by the Democratic governor. Here's what the Supreme Court says, and this is analyzing. We've actually talked about the Coleman case. That was the Kansas members of the legislature in terms of voting for a constitutional amendment. The Supreme Court said, as this court has observed, Coleman stands for the proposition that legislators whose votes would have been sufficient to defeat a specific legislative act have standing to sue if that legislative action goes into effect. Nothing of that sort happened here. Unlike Coleman, this case does not concern the results of a legislative chamber's poll or the validity of any counted or uncounted vote. As we have already explained, a single house of a bicameral legislature, and this is, I think, the critical words, generally lacks standing to appeal in cases of this order. End of quote. So I get why, on its face, you would think that seems to mean you need both houses. But here's why I think you don't. Because unlike the Republican state legislature in Virginia, the Democratic House of Representatives does have an injury. Their argument is Donald Trump should have brought his emoluments to Congress where we could vote on whether to allow him to accept them or not. And as the House of Representatives, we would have voted no, and then he would have been prohibited from taking those emoluments, even if the Senate voted yes. We could have blocked it, right? Yes, because it requires approval by both houses of Congress.
Oh, so it's not... Okay, yep. So it's not like passing a law, yep. Exactly. It's like
it's the opposite.
Default is no. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
So they could have blocked it. It would not have been approved by Congress, and they were deprived of their opportunity to block that case. So I think certainly nothing wrong with the analysis. It is what you would expect. It is the argument that I think the other side would make. But I think the much better reading of that case is that there is an injury suffered to the House here. They have not had the opportunity to vote on whether the president should get to keep these contributions from foreign officials. And if they had that opportunity, they could block it. And that is word for word what the Supreme Court says that the Coleman case stands for. So I think I thank you for the correction, but I'm standing by my suggestion that the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives could and should bring a new emoluments clause now that they are the majority in the House of Representatives.
Have we heard anything about this? Because, yeah, I mean, it seems like, why not do it? Any rumblings? Any news?
No, I have not heard anything that that there is a new one. And look, I get that there's a certain level of fatigue, right? We do this show twice a week. I certainly do get that, but I stand behind it.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's any representatives listening.
We know there are some, who listen to the show. So
we do.
Yeah. So,
like. U.S. House of Representatives, some state level ones.
And some candidates, and we have some strong suppositions at the federal
level. Well, contact your local Nancy Pelosi, and I don't know. Let's get this going. Let's do this. It couldn't hurt. What is it? Yeah, let's try it.
I agree.
Keep trying, everybody.
Yep, keep trying.
You helped Michael by putting your hand on his chest and doing some sort of healing magic.
Yeah, a nurse did that to calm me down once when I crashed my jet ski into a manatee.
You crashed your jet ski into a manatee?
Yeah, I'm from Jacksonville, Florida. It happens a lot.
All right. Well, now it's time for our main segment, which I think is perhaps some good news. There was a good decision in the Florida felons case. This was, from my memory, the voters decided that in Florida, ex-convicts ought to have some right to vote in some form. And then Republicans said, not on my watch. We're going to do poll tax stuff and all this crap to make sure this law doesn't take effect. And then it went through the courts. And now it seems like there's a good result in the 11th Circuit. How'd I do? Give us the update, Andrew.
Yeah, that is right in the main. So in 2018, Florida residents voted overwhelmingly, right, two-thirds, 65%, to restore voting rights to felons who had completed their sentences. And because nobody in Florida is allowed to have good things, they also voted in a Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, and they voted Rick Scott to the Senate. I mean, you know, to do better, Florida. And oh, by the way, Rick Scott's outgoing plan was to pack the Florida Supreme Court with hidebound conservatives, and that turned out to go into effect, or, you know, not have any
yeah, that was going to be this big dramatic thing, and then we did, couldn't win.
The yeah. And then we couldn't so win matter. The governorship. That's right. So, so yeah. So then the Republican state legislature got together and passed SB 7066, which said, oh yeah, we are implementing Amendment 4. And by the way, serving your sentence means paying all of your outstanding legal financial obligations. I need to tell you that that position is not remotely legally defensible. But it doesn't matter because Republican Governor Ron DeSantis sent a letter to his partisan Republican friends on the Florida Supreme Court requesting an advisory opinion that completing all terms of sentence in Amendment 4 included paying all fines, right, as implemented by SB 7066. And the Florida Supreme Court said, yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. No, of course that's what that phrase means, right? That, you yeah, know, right. you don't complete your sentence if you still owe, you know, $78 in court costs. Just as a quick sidebar, we should do an entire episode on the way in which recurring fines trap those in poverty sort of at the margins of the justice system. It's horrendous and awful. And Republicans 100% know what they are doing when they say this, right? This would completely gut the entirety of the amendment. So Florida Supreme Court says, obviously that's part of what completing your sentence means. And then various felons who have completed their sentence went and filed a class action lawsuit and sought an injunction to stop SB 7066 from going into effect. And the key question, so this is an injunction that was granted at the district court level and 2 days ago upheld by a 3-judge panel of the 11th Circuit. And as you know, Thomas, that the criteria for granting an injunction, right, 4-part balancing test, as always, the major prong of whether you can get an injunction is likelihood of success on the merits. And so the fundamental question was, are you likely to succeed that this law, SB 7066, is unconstitutional? And the argument is not that it is unconstitutional as a poll tax, so to speak. The argument is that it is an unconstitutional form of discrimination on the basis of protecting a fundamental right, which is the restricting access to the fundamental right, which is a right to vote. And the 11th Circuit works through this in, I'm going to include the opinion in the show notes, and I would encourage you, even if you're not a law student, I would encourage you to read this opinion because it is a very, very thoughtful, considered, intelligent opinion. It is the kind of opinion, and I don't say that just because I like the result that they've reached. It is the kind of judicial writing that I wish we saw more of, particularly in the age of Trump. And that's because the 11th Circuit looks through and says, look, our job is to try and figure out what the law is. And this is a hard question. And the reason that it's a hard question, I'm going to quote a little bit from the opinion here. We look through a different prism when the law classifies in certain suspect ways on the basis of race, gender, or national origin, or classifies in a way that burdens fundamental rights. Those classifications get heightened scrutiny, a more exacting form of review. And then they say, this starts at page 20, the appropriate level of scrutiny here is not immediately obvious. This case does not fit the traditional categories that call for heightened scrutiny. And why is that? Because wealth is not a suspect classification, right? Discriminating on somebody on the basis of money, even if you're discriminating against poor people, is not like discriminating against black people. That's, the Supreme Court has been very, very clear that that's the way it breaks down, right?
Can we fix that? Like, maybe it should be?
We can fix that legislatively. We cannot fix it in terms of interpreting the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
Okay. And I would love, let's put a pin in that. I would love to do a discussion about that at some point. So on the one hand, being poor is not a suspect class under the Supreme Court's Equal Protection Clause jurisprudence. But then the court continues. On the other hand, it is not obvious that rational basis review is appropriate, right? And there they look at a couple of cases and they say, because we're not talking about discriminating against poor people just, you know, in terms of access to services or, you know, mm-hmm. so we're talking about restricting access to a fundamental right, right? So, yeah. So on the one hand, right, half the signs point to yes, half the signs point to no. And then they say, the Supreme Court has routinely referred to the right to vote as fundamental. And thus, in cases where classifications restrict access to vote, the Supreme Court has held heightened scrutiny applies. But, and so they say, okay, so on the one hand, right, we say, all right, generally okay to discriminate against poor people. On the other hand,
we're all cool. Yeah. With that. Yeah. Agreed. Agreed. Yeah,
on the other hand, generally not okay to discriminate against anybody's right to vote. Right. On the third hand, only two cases have ever looked at this exact question, right? That is wealth discrimination in automatic felon re-enfranchisement cases, right? In a, that quote, as a practical matter, deny indigent felons access to the franchise. Both cases, one in the Sixth Circuit and one that was a state Supreme Court in Washington, held that rational basis scrutiny applied because, quote, felons do not have a fundamental right to vote and wealth is not a suspect classification. So only two courts have analyzed that specific question, the question of, is it okay for a legislature to impose qualifications on restoring voting rights to felons? And both of them, one was a Sixth Circuit case, one was a state Supreme Court case in Washington, both held that rational basis applied, that you did not get heightened scrutiny because, quote, felons do not have a fundamental right to vote and wealth is not a suspect classification. But, so that seems bad, right? So that's what you have to distinguish against. And then the 11th Circuit said, you know what, we're going to go through this. Ultimately, they held that heightened scrutiny did apply, and I'm going to explain why in a minute. But then they also engaged in what we typically call judgment proofing a case, right? And that is beginning on page 21 saying, but you know what? Even if only rational basis scrutiny applied here, this might not pass rational basis. That's a pretty big statement to make. Here's their analysis. They say, under rational basis, we will not overturn a statute unless the varying treatment of different groups or persons is so unrelated to the achievement of any combination of legitimate purposes that we can only conclude that the legislature's actions were irrational, right? And I told you, you know, that lawyers sometimes call this the fogged mirror test, right? But here's what it says. So the question we ask is whether the legislature could have conceived of a rational basis for the classification it drew. And then adding, that doesn't have to be right. Here's how the court says that. They say, a legislative choice is not subject to courtroom fact-finding and may be based on rational speculation, quote, unsupported by evidence or empirical data, end of quote. So, for example, one of the leading cases on rational basis is a case called Vance versus Bradley, in which the Supreme Court upheld a law that set the mandatory retirement for foreign service officers at age 60. And the Supreme Court said, although empirical proof that health and energy tend to decline somewhat by age 60 would have been good evidence for upholding the statute, those challenging the legislative judgment must show, quote, not only that the facts do not support the classification, but, even more onerously, that the facts on which the classification is based could not reasonably be conceived to be true by the governmental decision maker. Get that? So,
nah, I'm not totally sure I understand. Doesn't this, unless I'm misunderstanding, doesn't this make rational basis like nothing? Like,
it makes it almost, that's why it is the fogged mirror, right? It makes it,
yeah,
almost nothing.
It's not really rational basis. It's just basis.
Yeah, it is any sort of any conceivable. Basis.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then, as the 11th Circuit points out, traditional rational basis review is highly deferential, but not toothless. In other words, it is possible to strike down a statute for...
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Trump's crack legal team has messed this up a few times. Yeah. They're like, gosh, the Supreme Court was like, I can't believe it, but like, there's not even a rational basis here.
And they say, when we review a statute for rationality, generally we ask whether there is any basis, any rational basis for the law, even if the government's proffered explanation is irrational, and even if it fails to offer any explanation at all. So yeah, that's sort of anticipating Donald Trump there. And here, what the 11th Circuit says is, if we look at the question as applied, right, with respect to these particular plaintiffs, the distinction that the 11th Circuit draws that I think is really key to analysis here is that the statute prohibits re-enfranchising felons who would like to pay off their fines but can't, right? And here's what the court says. If the question on rational basis review were whether the LFO requirement, right, and by LFO, that means legal financial obligations, so paying off their fines.
That was a low-frequency oscillator. Right.
Is rational as applied to those unable to pay, we think it is clearly not. The continued disenfranchisement of felons who were genuinely unable to pay LFOs and who have made a good faith effort to do so does not further any legitimate state interest that we can discern. And that's a really, really good point, right? All of the justifications for, well, why should you continue to deny them the, you know, why should we grant the franchise to people who still haven't made good on their debt to society? If the response back to that is, well, they're trying, right? They'd like to, right? Then there's no further sort of deterrence benefit and their sentence is over. So there's no further punitive nature that the state can impose. And I think the 11th Circuit's reading here is pretty persuasive. Obviously, if heightened scrutiny applies, it's a no-brainer, right? And there is a case called Bearden versus Georgia. It's a 1983 Supreme Court decision.
I got to say, that's kind of frustrating, though. Look, if we're supposed to apply any sort of scrutiny to this, then of course it fails. Yeah. But if by some legal trick we don't have to really look at it, then sure, maybe. It's kind of frustrating.
Yeah,
right?
But they say, but even then, probably not here, which is, you know, how far it goes. But yeah, so if there is heightened scrutiny, it's a no-brainer. Bearden versus Georgia, there was a statute that revoked probation based on a failure to pay a fine that a defendant was unable to pay. And the Supreme Court said very clearly, that's unconstitutional discrimination on the basis of wealth, right? Whether analyzed in terms of equal protection or due process, this issue cannot be resolved by resort to easy slogans or pigeonhole analysis. The heightened scrutiny requires balancing all of the various interests, and ultimately the Supreme Court said, yeah, if you can't pay, then we can't say, oh, well, you know, your probation is revoked until you can pay. That was not constitutionally permissible as a statute. So that's the analysis that the 11th Circuit did. They did one more thing that I think is really key. And again, this will be upheld in the future. We're going to talk about the future of this decision in a minute. And that is the question of severability, right? And we've talked about that before, whether it's a contract or a law. Oftentimes you will ask, okay, this one thing is bad. Can this bad thing be severed out of a contract or a law?
Right.
And then should we still uphold the original contract or the law? Right. And the test, obviously different legal environments, there are different ways of phrasing it, but the intuitive way to understand the test is, again, a fairness provision, right? So if I say, hey, I'm going to give you, you know, $100,000 in exchange for you granting me mining rights on this piece of property, And then I go and go to mine the property, and that contravenes, right? You know, it's now a federally protected wetland, right? I go to court and I get the contract itself thrown out, right? And we say, look, the reason I was giving you the $100,000 was to mine on the property. I can't mine. Therefore, you don't get my $100,000. It's, you would not say, it would obviously be ridiculous to say, oh, no, no, well, we're legally tossing out the bit where you get to mine, but there's no law prohibiting you from giving $100,000 to somebody. Yeah. So go right ahead, right? That would be ridiculous, right? But when you're talking about legislation, the question tends to turn far more in the direction, there tends to be a presumption in favor of severing out legislation, right? Unless it's clear that something is an integral part, you can save the legislation by severing out the unconstitutional bit. And we talked about that, for example, in the NFIB versus Sebelius decision, right? Which upheld the rest of Obamacare while maintaining the individual mandate on a different justification than that proffered in the original statute. And here, I mean, just sort of without going line by line, six pages, starting at page 73, the 11th Circuit goes through and says, okay, the Florida State Supreme Court said that paying fines was part of Amendment 4. So now the question is that part, which we've now said is unconstitutional, is that severable from the rest of the constitutional amendment restoring the franchise? Or would voters have not voted in the constitutional amendment if they knew that that meant that those who didn't have to pay their fines would not have to pay their fines?
How are they going to evaluate that?
And
survey the public and be like, why did you vote for this?
Yeah, no, what they said was they looked at the general purpose underlying the law and said the purpose underlying the law here was to restore voting rights to felons who had completed their sentences. Mm-hmm. And
that seems like a no-brainer. Yeah,
absolutely a no-brainer. 100% should be severable. There is a strong presumption in favor of severability. So, yeah, we can cut out this onerous requirement tacked on by the legislature that wasn't even spelled out in the amendment in the first place and still affirm overall Amendment 4 to the Constitution. And that's what they did. So this is a great decision. It's a well-reasoned decision. And it is, even if you are conservative, even if you disagree with the outcome, it's an exceptionally well-written decision and one that I would encourage you to you know, cuddle up with an 80-page decision and read it.
By the fireplace.
Yeah, yeah. It's what, nice it's cold outside, so...
Look, we know what you like to do with documents, we do. Andrew. Anyway, we don't want to spend time on it. It's disturbing to some listeners.
Well, you know, keep a set under the pillow. So, yeah, this is a really, really good decision. And so I am setting you up for the question I know that you want to ask.
Oh, well, how's the Supreme Court going to treat this one? Are we just screwed? It's going to be a great, thoughtful, well-written decision. And then, you know, Kavanaugh's going to be like, no, or something.
So here's what's next. Okay. Look, I'm nervous about that, too. There are a couple things that you should know. So the first is the 11th Circuit is a very, very conservative circuit. Huh. But this was like going in and rolling 3-1s in terms of the judges that got assigned. So the panel was Barbara Rothstein, who...
Oh, it was just like the liberals on the conservative
side. It's even better than that. She is a senior status judge from the U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia, sitting by designation in the 11th Circuit. This happens. I don't have the time to go through like all the crazy procedural rules where senior judges can get assigned to different courts, but not an 11th Circuit judge and assigned to the case by this Byzantine process. Then the other two judges are R. Lanier Anderson III, who was a Carter appointee who was on senior status. And then the third judge was Stanley Marcus. Again, not a liberal, a conservative 85 Reagan appointee who was then elevated to the 11th Circuit by Bill Clinton back in the late 90s and is also on senior status. So basically, you had kind of the platonic ideal of three judges on senior status who really like were free to sit around and like answer a tough legal question rather than like think about the political implications of this. I mean, you know, really what our framers intended in terms of giving judges lifetime tenure, right? So an atypical panel, a clearly apolitical decision. And now Florida will have two options. They can petition for an en banc review by the entire 11th Circuit, which again, more conservative, or they can go straight to the Supreme Court. And in both cases, so a couple of things here. I think the 11th Circuit absolutely would take this case en banc. It's a novel, unique, important case that has a lot of undecided law in it. And for the same reason, I think the Supreme Court would grant cert. But then the question is, what happens to this judgment in the interim? And remember that the burden shifts when you've won injunctive relief, that now the burden would shift to the state of Florida to persuade a court under the same standard that the law is strongly in their favor pending appeal in order to stay the effect of this judgment. And for all of the reasons why this is a tough case are reasons why I could see the 11th Circuit and even our Supreme Court saying, yeah, okay, we're gonna consider whether to grant cert. We're going to take a look at this case, but we're not going to stay this judgment from going into effect.
Time for the election?
In time for the 2020 election. So now...
Well, everybody's got to get registered and stuff.
Yes, absolutely. Folks will have to get registered. Absolutely, we will have to see. This court will stay... I need to be 100% clear on this. This court will stay the effects of its own judgment pending appeal, right? So the judgment will not go into effect... and the state will stay its, the 11th Circuit will stay its mandate, right? The decision came out a couple of days ago in order to give the other side an opportunity to appeal, right? That is typical and fair, right? Like you don't want to say like, nope, going into effect right now, nothing you can do about it. And I have not seen, I've looked to see this was entered yesterday, as of the time of this recording, I looked to see if there was an order staying the mandate. That has not been entered yet. It will be entered. So there will be time. There will be about a month in which the other side will get the opportunity to either petition for en banc review or take a cert petition to the Supreme Court of the United States. And again, this goes to the Supreme Court of the United States because it's a question of interpreting the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. So we will see what happens, but we will know in a little over a month, in 30 to 45 days time, depending on the stay order, whether either the full 11th Circuit or the U.S. Supreme Court will grant an emergency injunction staying this mandate from going into effect. And so keep your eyes on this space. We will obviously continue to cover that. It's possible that it won't. And look, like I'd love to tell you it definitely won't. I can't tell you that with the Supreme Court. But I can tell you this is a good decision from a tough environment, and there is some chance that we will have a favorable environment in Florida in 2020. And that's as good a news as you're going to get these days.
Yeah.
So sit back and enjoy it.
Yeah. It's the tiny little, diamond in the middle of this massive piece of coal that we had to dig through. I'm excited sort of about this, but at the same time, is there going to be sort of damage done, you know, where it's like, well, this should have been, what, a year ago now or more, where this should have just gone into effect and people should have been able to get ready to vote in the next election and to do what they need to do. And is it already, I wonder how much damage is already done by all this and the fact that it could be another, like you say, a month, month and a half before we even have any idea whether or not these people get to vote. So, you know, how much damage is already going to be done by that, do you think?
A lot of damage is already being done by that.
But maybe get out the vote. Maybe there's some efforts we can do to, it, assuming things go our way in this, to get everybody registered in time. Is there any BS other voter suppression law they've done where you can't register, you know, a year in advance or something?
Not that I know of, but again, not that I would put past anyone. So,
yeah,
look, like it is important to, this is, you know, this is why we say stay active, you know, at the local level and don't give up on fighting those fights.
Well, nice job, Andrew, because you've just earned yourself a wild card segment. Ding, ding, ding,
all
ding,
right.
Ding. Yeah, you did it. And here's what you've won. Opening Arguments is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. I'm here to tell you that hiring is hard. It's hard on many levels. It's hard because you want someone great. You want to make sure you have the right candidate. But any time, any additional time you take, you know, in your search, if you're not liking the resumes you're seeing, that is more time that the position is not filled. You've probably, you or somebody else or the whole team are trying to catch up with the work involved in that position not being filled. It increases the stress, and then that kind of pressures you into hiring someone maybe you don't want. Well, ZipRecruiter.com/OA is where you want to go to avoid all that stress and to find good candidates fast. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. You can even add screening questions to your job listing so you can filter candidates and focus on the best ones. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, to try ZipRecruiter for free, our listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
A question from listener Brian Brazil, who I hope is like the brother of Brody Brazil, the analyst for my San Jose Sharks. Let me know. I maybe could score some tickets or something. Anyway, would a citizen be able to obtain a writ of mandamus for Mitch McConnell to vote on all of the indefinitely tabled bills? It doesn't seem like a stretch to say that there's an abuse of discretion occurring or that they aren't fulfilling their duties. Now, the Negatron in me quickly is like, well, no, that's part of the job of being a senator or being, I guess, the majority leader is you get to just do this. Like, that's part of your job. But since we're asking the question, maybe we'll find out there's more to it. What's going on?
Yeah, unfortunately, Negatron Thomas is correct. No.
All hail Negatron. Look, Negatron is always right.
Look, this was super clever and, you know, plus 5 points for style. Here's the legal standard, right? So remember, a writ of mandamus is when a government official has to do a thing but refuses to do that thing. And you can go to court and say, do that thing, right? And the key linchpin whenever you're thinking about mandamus is if the official has any discretion in whether to do the thing or not, then you can't get mandamus, right?
Yeah.
If it is ministerial, administrative, you can, right? So let me give you a really, really good example in an area that has a lot of uncertainty to it. Our episode 360 discussing the Equal Rights Amendment, the National Archivist has to add a valid constitutional amendment to the Constitution in the National Archives. And so part of the relief that is sought in that lawsuit being brought by the state of Virginia and the subsequently ratifying states, is we want a writ of mandamus telling the archivist that he's got to write this down. That's the kind of thing for which you can get mandamus. Here's how the legal standard is spelled out. A writ of mandamus is warranted when a party establishes, one, that the right to issuance of the writ is clear and indisputable, two, that the party has no other adequate means to obtain the relief sought, and three, that the writ is appropriate under the circumstances. And here, the two main things where your Mitch McConnell writ is going to fall short is number one, on the discretion point, right? Mitch McConnell gets to decide whether to table a bill or not. So you can't mandamus him to untable the bill. And even if you could, there would be a standing problem, which is that generalized grievances that are not the invasion of a legally protected interest do not give rise to a cognizable injury under the law. That must be concrete and particularized. And what that means is that standing to sue may not be predicated upon an interest which is held in common by all members of the public because of the necessarily abstract nature of the injury that all citizens share. And so what that means, and I'm sorry, and I don't know that I would defend this position, but you're screwing up all of our democracy for all of us is the kind of thing that the Supreme Court has said does not give rise to standing. You have to say, oh no, you're harming me individually or me and this class of people in a very specific, concrete, and particularized way in order to bring your lawsuit. So super clever. I really like it. Keep doing it. Because sometimes you send those
Brian
through.
Brian Brazil, we tried. Yeah. We tried, look, Brian Brazil. Good
folks
job.
Have asked, right? And I have changed my mind on things where I look at it and go, well, obviously not that. And sometimes, well, obviously not that is wrong. Sometimes I think that it's clearly one way, but when you look at the law, you see, oh, well, you know what? Like maybe not. And not in this one, but keep sending them in.
All right. Well, good try. Keep at it. Maybe we'll find that one weird trick. In the meantime, we've got to do what we do every Tuesday, which is Top Patron Tuesday over on patreon.com/law. And we begin with Mitch McConnell's Yodel Mountain Top Removal Service. Yeah. Samuel Bland. Wait for it. The next patron name is super funny. This Patreon name is a lot more pressure than I was expecting. That's the next one. So now is that building up to the next one? Obligatory Seattle Live Show plug. I can't believe it's a Patreon name. After the Seattle Live Show, it's just more Seattle Live Shows. Ian Buckley. Ziegenhagen, Ziegenhagen, oi, oi, oi. A bunch of question marks. Adam called my Senator Larson. Kristen Daniel. Let me be clear. I like being totally see-through. I wonder if Andrew and Thomas will read quotes from Belinda Blinky. What's that?
You got me on that one.
I don't know. Sorry. Murray Gregerson, Colleen Wilson, Lawfulcopter. India is shooting students protesting against bigotry. Can we get CERT to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect T3BE answers? Support the co-op economy. I've given pleasure to the world because I have such a beautiful... that's a weird one. Upping my patronage to support new OA YouTube videos. Oh, thank you so much. Everyone else should do that and also watch the videos, please. Let me be totally clear. Torres Smith, 2024. Amber Green, what's more likely, a Shark Stanley Cup or a Raleigh live show? Well, this year, you know, you got me on that one. As much as there's no chance of a Raleigh live show, there's zero chance of a Shark Stanley Cup.
I love the Raleigh-Durham greater area, so definitely Raleigh live show.
Definitely that. There's more chance of that. Clear eyes, full hearts, totally clear. Zirkel, Freudian face plant. Clown Hornet, Dallas Live Show, Whiteboard, Punch It, Brenda. Seattle Live Show, advocacy complete, going back to old pledge level. No, it's still unclear whether or not we're going to do that. Donald Trump is a lying dog-faced pony soldier. Emily Rainbow Spence, the unprecedented, resented, demented president defenestrated, Jason Kopis, screw you, Dentine, lots of things are colder than ice. Dentine, sorry. Man Chicken. The Allspark is in Raleigh. Transform and roll. Well, you just got Andrew. He'll go there. Looking forward to the 2020 Marble Olympics. Thank you, Gels Marble Runs. Huh. Hotspur live show in Barcelona will make up with tapas and sangria. What?
Ooh.
My blanket, my blue blanket. Give me my blue blanket. Dragonfly.eco, books about nature and the environment, reviews and interviews. It's legal, it's advice, it's opening arguments live in Vegas. Michelle Cloud, track like salespeople who used to be lawyers. Nate Drex, stuff and polls. Spoon feed your kid from the grave because you know they are an F up. Darth Mandy Pants, I am Batman. Seattle Show, have gourmet food, whiskey, wine, and dogs and cats to snuggle. Umminum Brewing, 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Trump reportedly shouts, I am the law before issuing pardons. Pain don't hurt. Jennifer Cratch. Remain indoors. I'm here because Diogenes the Cynic was right. I remember when shame was a thing. Spaghetti, the noodle without a moral arc. Soft weeping of the shame boners. Stephen Balticate Sandoval. Shoop Gita 4-4. Jeff Galbach. I have lost the will to be funny in this nightmare timeline. Of course, Larry Klayman is representing George Zimmerman. Yeah. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. The Registry Matters Podcast. Insurance Adjusters for Trump 2021. John Bilderbeck. Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious. Seattle, home of Westland Distillery. Tons of corgis and OA live shows. And it's your turn.
And thank you to P. Andrew Tortoise. Gerrymandering is Abusive Power. Catherine Cannell. Clownhornvoting.com thinks Bloomberg should pay the fees of every felon in Florida. What a timely insert right there.
Can you do that? Do we cover that? Can you
Yeah. As long as as long as those obligations are met.
Friggin' easy would that be?
Should be. War in 2020. Altman Photo and Design. Clownhorn the Live Show. I just want dinner in Seattle. Payne's Trumpet. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew's a close second. Trump's 2020 campaign will look like Weekend at Bernie's. 13th century Saxony Graveman truck lawyer. Kiowa Valley exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. The Wandering Gambler. Let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. If precedence has you down, make it original with pretextualism. Milo Mead Song stands in solidarity with UW nurses and their union. Love you, Thomas, but Jesus, make up your T3BE mind. You're killing me. If the other team cheats, I just...
Oh, sorry. Was the 7 in a row not good enough for you?
If the other team cheats, I just play with Mike Hawk. Oh, man. I will be 12 years old forever. Our first and only favorite karaoke legend, Cosmo Blues. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. It's a Yodel Stairmaster. Someday this podcasting empire will rule the galaxy. Adam Costa, James Call, Jay Aldenwalt. Average underwear are known as OK Bloomers. That's excellent. No. Two for Minneapolis Live Show, Anonymous. What kind of Patreon name do you have that Andrew won't read? Well, not that one. Yochai Benkler's Network Propaganda Explains Everything. Read it now. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Closing concessions. I'm glad Andrew agrees it's a Yodel Stairmaster. Well, I put it that way. But P. Andrew Taurus is homeomorphic to P. Andrew Coffee Cup. That is true, and I love all math geekery-related puns, so good work. Draft Adam Schiff at the Brokered Convention. Well, you may be getting closer to that than you think. Two votes for Denver Live Show. That's Puzzle in a Thunderstorm Law. Derek? The little people's opinion on sports law doesn't concern a patron. This pod brought to you by the righteous fury of E. Warren. Florida Man wants Florida Live Shows and Mayor Pete. Big Easy Blasphemy. The Yodeler achieved escape velocity and now is in orbit. Yeah. Rhonda wants an Alaskan Live Show before it all melts. CampQuest.org says check out secularwoman.org. Ooh, I'm going to have to check that out. Mm. Bob Barr is my least favorite attorney general. I think he means Bill Barr, but Bob Barr, the now ex-California Congress or ex Anyway, Bill Barr, I'm going to say, is my least favorite Attorney General. Jeff Sessions is a close second. Sam Buck, yeah. David in Brooklyn, Malika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, Soggy Pants, Amanda... You almost got me. Amanda, my balls itch. Nice. Matthew Vernon, adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Don't take ramp building advice from a podcast. Heather L. Sakashite Fukasumi, OA live show at QEDCon in October. You know you want to. I would love to do that. But
we would. Aren't they, tell them.
Isn't QEDCon on hiatus this year?
No, that was last year.
Well, then, all right.
Back. Although it's not really an OA place. Like, it's about other stuff.
It's definitely an OA place. It's, you know, skepticism and science and law. And
there's nothing that screams, can I have a show about American law, like being in Manchester?
Exactly. Right. We want to be there. Make it happen, folks. Demand OA Live at QEDCon.
Make it so.
Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Allie, Dan Irizarry, Sam Danow, Eli Bosnick. I voted for the murderer war in 2020. Alexandra Chalupa, a.k.a. Natasha Crunchwrap. Mitchell, Stormy promised us D-picks. Mayor Bloomberg wants us all to sign an NDA about that debate. Yeah. I agree with that 100%. And of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, but, you know, give it a try if you can, Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much. And again, remember, you want to be read out every single week, every time on Top Patron Tuesday. Head on over, patreon.com/law. Sign up at the $5 level. And you know, according to the terms and conditions therein, we will read whatever embarrassing, sophomoric, hilarious, Amanda My Balls Itch, like whatever. We can be bought. And you should try and buy us.
All right. Well, now it's time for T3BE, the answer.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
Yeah. So, Thomas, this was a question about a plaintiff suing a defendant regarding a written contract between an engineer and an owner to serve in the essential position of on-site supervisor. But before the contract can begin, the engineer is injured and rendered physically incapable of performing. He says, hey, I can serve as the off-site consultant for the same pay. Is the owner likely to prevail in an action for damages resulting from his failure to perform under the contract? You narrowed it down to one no answer, no. Because the engineer's physical ability to perform as on-site supervisor was a basic assumption of the contract, or D, yes, because the engineer's duty to perform was personal and absolute. I am here to tell you one of those two answers is correct.
Ooh.
Unfortunately, your 7 question winning streak comes to an end. This is a super, super hard question. It is B.
I only narrowed it down to B and D because B was so confusing that I was like, well, since none of the other answers look like amazing, maybe it's that one and I don't know why. So at least I did that.
So here's the thing, right? The key, and this is super hard, but look, the bar is hard. So, you know, this just underscores just how good your 7 question winning streak was.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
The key word in the question is prevail in an action for damages.
Damages.
Right?
Yeah.
So in this case, what happens is the engineer is not in breach of the contract, because the incapacity to perform your duty under a contract renders that performance, this is called the defense of impracticability, and operates as an excuse for non-performance, right? So no damages against the engineer. It's not his fault that, you know.
You know, I actually zeroed in on that initially, and I wasn't sure. I was a little confused on it. Sounds like I should have listened to my instincts a little more on that.
Yep. And so it look, he's not going to have to pay the guy, right?
Right, but he's not getting damages
even though he's essential to the contract. And so then the question is.
But I'm not sure why that. Okay, so so if I had known it was a no answer on that logic, I probably would have guessed B, because A doesn't really sound like the right reason.
Well, A is wrong as a matter of law, right? Yeah. So A says no because the engineer offered a reasonable substitute.
I'm not a lawyer. I'm talking about how I would narrow it down as a non-lawyer.
Fair enough. But A says that you offered a reasonable substitute by offering to serve as an offsite consultant. That is not an excuse for a breach of contract, right? When you do less than what the contract asks for, even if it's reasonable, that does not excuse a breach.
Okay. Can you explain B? I don't think you'd really explain that.
So the way it works is the fact that the on-site service was a basic assumption of the contract, right, means that offering less than the ability to serve as the on-site supervisor is not a reasonable substitute, right? So let me give you an example of what constitutes a reasonable substitute. You agree to buy 1,000 apples from my orchard. My truck breaks down, and so I rent a different truck. And I say, I'm going to bring it by a truck that has, you know, my name on the outside or whatever. And then my truck breaks down, so I bring you the apples via a different truck, right? It's a different way of complying with the contract, but it's exactly the same thing. You still get your apples on time, so that is a reasonable substitute for my performance.
Yeah.
I have properly performed under the contract. Here, I can't perform under the contract because I'm hurt. I can't be on site. Mm-hmm. When I offer to go off site, I am not performing. I am in breach of that contract. But the question is my breach excused or not? And so I am excused by virtue of the fact that I physically can't do it, right? The law doesn't require me to do a thing that's impossible for me to do. So the wording is super duper tricky.
Really tricky wording. And
it really is.
Again, I zeroed in on that from the beginning, but I couldn't quite, I almost could have guessed B. I was so close because it's so confusing that I thought there was something like usually you can, even the wrong answers, you can get the logic of them. They're not usually like gobbledygook, you know? And I just couldn't even figure out why that wording was. I still don't entirely understand it. So you said the key was damages, right?
Yep.
So you don't get damages
because the non-performance is excused.
How does that answer mean? Because if the answer says because the engineer's physical ability to perform as on-site supervisor was a basic assumption of the contract.
Right. So that means that it is a key material term of the contract, right? That anything less than physically being able to perform as on-site supervisor does not comply with the contract, right? So the first part is he in breach? And the answer to that is yes. Then the second half is that breach excused? And the engineers.
And so the answer is saying like, because the physical, needing to be there is so core to the contract, then yes, it's excused.
It leaves out, right?
That's what it tries
to. Yeah. Look. This, I'm really glad we're doing this because the answer leaves out that justification, right? It leaves out this is crucial to the contract and his inability to do that is excused because of his physical limitations, right? Bar answers sometimes do that, right? Like sometimes what you have to do is figure out the best of a group of bad answers.
Yeah.
And here, right, when you go through and analyze it properly, the answer is no, and B is a better no answer than A. I agree with you. B is written incredibly badly. And
I will tell you this,
a tip on the bar exam is when something is written, when something is written incredibly badly, it's either written badly because it's the right answer and it's trying to throw you off, or as an attractive distractor, but it's definitely not one you should ignore.
Yeah, I know.
It's the same rule.
No, and I almost got there.
You did great. It's the same rule as
the, like, grab the mystery men quote, where he's like, they're either very smart or very dumb.
That's right. Like that, and I have told you this on several occasions, but I'll repeat it again because we get new listeners that come into the show. The same thing is true on the bar exam when you have an unbelievably stupid sounding answer, right? One time out of four, like, it's just the stupid answer. The other three times, it's like, you know, what kind of a lunatic wrote these answers? But one time in four, the stupid, simple answer is the correct one. So this is the corollary of that sometimes the overly complex answer is the best sneaky way.
Gosh, to put it's it heartbreaking that I was close. I mean, it would have taken incredible guts to guess B, because
it would have.
Know, it's such a weird, but like I came about as close as I could have, you know, in that I got that the right away that the language was weird. I saw that the damages part was like, I was kind of puzzling through that, but not quite there. That's the difference between a lawyer and a guy who just
this has is some a decent instincts. Super, super hard question. So I
very hard question. All right. The streak ends. I lost. Yeah. You know,
get back. It wasn't on like that an unicycle. Upset.
I didn't lose to the worst team in the league. I you know, I came up against the Patriots and I fell short or something like
next
that.
Next time I'll bang a trash can on the right answer.
No, never. Never. Sanctity of the game.
Sanctity of the game.
All right. It makes the 7-question streak that much more beautiful that it happened. We can all enjoy it and now it's gone and maybe never happen again. We'll see. All right. It's over. Oh, well, let's check in the time machine and see who won. I wonder who got this right. It feels like it's got to be a lawyer. But maybe a normie got this one. We'll see.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, a lot of folks played along this week, and some folks followed your train of logic. A lot of people managed to actually catch that the significant phrase in the question was damages against the poor injured engineer. And we had a variety. We had some really, really funny ones, some great pun-loaded ones, for example. Jeremy Magi wrote in with a really fantastic answer, but I think we're going to give the win this week to the earliest and most concise answer from Dan Rose, who writes, I'm going with B. The engineer didn't breach the contract. The contract just no longer makes sense. And while that's not the best legal analysis, I thought it was a really, really good intuitive analysis that matches up with the legal result. So congratulations, Dan, on being this week's winner. And everyone give him a follow. That is at Rotuami, at Rotuami on Twitter. And congratulations for being this week's winner, Dan.
All right. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. You know, please support the show on patreon.com/law. It's what makes the show go. What's, you know, every week I'm amazed at Andrew's preparation and ability to deliver, you know, two full episodes of insight in the way that he does. And if you like that as much as I do, hop on over to Patreon, support the show. All right. We will see you folks on Rapid Response Friday.
You betray the law!
All right.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.